Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did North Texas oil barons make waves from two off-the-grid islands near Port Aransas? Not long after Clint Murchison of Dallas started buying up swaths of Matagorda Island to build a ranch and guest house, his dear friend Sid Richardson of Fort Worth bought nearby San Jose Island and began his own construction. In time, the two would use their complexes to host a wide variety of guests and to establish themselves, in the words of my guest, as the first oilmen kingmakers. Alan Peppard is a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of the three-part interactive series Islands of the Oil Kings. The final installment goes live today online at dallasnews.com. Alan, welcome to Think.
Chris, I am delighted to be here.
I love discovering stories about places that I had no idea existed or that are really interesting. How did these two islands come to your attention in the first place?
You have just articulated my favorite kind of story is that you read and go, wait, huh. You're kidding. I had no idea. The Murchison family and the Wynn family owned Matagorda, and I knew that story. And you always heard that Franklin Roosevelt had visited, and the story got amplified over the decades. Oh, Franklin Roosevelt used to go all the time, and Franklin Roosevelt this. And the stories, they never matched up. And like some of the stories I did for our JFK 50 series, I said, oh, to understand really what happened, I guess I'm going to have to go dig that out myself. And it began with me trying to dig out the story of Franklin Roosevelt's visit to both of those islands, May 9th, 1937. FDR Library was very helpful there. And then the story sort of grew.
So Clint Murchison and Sid Richardson were very close friends who seemed to prove that mantra that opposites attract. Can you compare their personality?
Clint Murchison had a real strain of silence to him, and I can testify to this because I am friends with his grandson, Clint III, and his father, Clint Jr., the middle generation, founded the Dallas Cowboys, was famously silent, you know, just unnervingly so. And Clint Sr. was very much that way. Sid Richardson was a very ebullient fellow, put his arm around you, slap you on the back, even if you were J. Edgar Hoover, even if you were Dwight Eisenhower, even if you were Franklin Roosevelt. I think he was a little more restrained with Roosevelt because he wasn't as certain of himself in those days. But they grew up together in Athens. They innately trusted each other. And it lasted for their entire lives.
So they grew up together as boys. They also grew up together sort of working and buying up oil leases. Do you think that they influenced one another's career paths?
Absolutely they did. And one thing that did influence the friendship, there really can't be an overemphasis on this, is Sid Richardson was in constant need of borrowed funds in his early days, and Clint Murchison's father owned the First National Bank of Athens.
It doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. And Clint was 4 years younger, and I do think that probably helped the relationship in the early days. But Sid ended up being much wealthier than Clint. And anyway, they had a tremendous influence on each other.
So in their young adulthood, Richardson had multiple reversals of fortune. Murchison had several heartbreaks.
He did. They drifted apart. They had, after World War I was over, Sid did not go to World War I because he had a carriage accident as a young man, and one of his legs was shorter than the other. And he tried to bluff his way through basic training, and they sent him home. And then when Clint got out of the Army, Sid said, look, there's money to be made in the oil fields. And I'm sorry, I lost the train of the question there.
Well, we were talking about, you know, Sid Richardson, you know, he was sort of up and down financially in the early years. And Clint Murchison lost a wife.
Oh, yes, that's right. So they started working together. But then Clint fell in love, got married, had three children. And Sid Richardson never married and was a bachelor, and they drifted apart for a while. And that is sort of how Clint's fortune began in East Texas, and Sid's really began in West Texas, because they were working apart. But then at 27 years old, Clint's wife suddenly took very ill, and they didn't know what it was, and it was a liver disease, and he sent a telegram to her mother in Tyler that you better come quick. And she was dead very fast, and he had three young boys to raise. And then Sid Richardson began to return into his life. Clint relocated to Dallas, and Sid Richardson would drive to Dallas every weekend from West Texas. And a real deep bond between the two developed in that period of sorrow. Clint was heartbroken, and Sid was broke, and with enormous debts. His ability to talk his way into further loans was very impressive.
And eventually it worked out for him.
It did. He knew what he was doing, although many bankers did not. He was deep into First National Bank of Fort Worth to the point that regulators started leaning on him. Now, remember, this is the Depression. They were leaning on the bank. You cannot take any more of Sid Richardson's paper. And the regulators came to talk to the bank. And the bank said, look, we can't do it. You go talk to him. And so the Federal Reserve guy goes and talks to Sid and then comes back and tells the bank, well, I think it's okay if maybe you lend him a little more money. Because he was convinced by Sid Richardson's line, okay, he's going to work his way out of this. And boy, he worked his way out of it. As Clint Murchison said, when those big fields started heading for Sid, it's the ultimate geologic compliment. Sid's really got the rocks, and he sure did.
All right, so how did both men finally arrive at a place where they wanted to buy an island? Even for a very wealthy person, this isn't something that everybody does.
If you track Clint Murchison's life, it was a pattern. He was a pioneer who built, just off the top of my head, I'm going to say five of these self-sustaining worlds in his life. And it began with Matagorda Island. They'd all go down there to Rockport, and they'd fish, and the fishing is still famous down there, but it was really famous in the 20s, redfish and tarpon. The tarpon don't run there like they used to. And he started noticing that Matagorda Island, well, boy, that would make a great hunting and fishing compound, but it's a brave thing to do. There's no electricity. Everything you need, you got to create it yourself, not to mention that all of those barrier islands are overrun with rattlesnakes, and there's more than a few alligators, and as I've said in story number two, mosquitoes the size of hummingbirds, and I was just down there, and I can testify to that. There was an archaeologist with me on Matagorda, and we got up next to the old house, which has now been not exactly abandoned, but let to grow over, and we're up close, and he says, Alan, there's about 500 mosquitoes on your back right now, so I just wouldn't worry about it.
Do you? It's always strange to go to a place that has been very opulent that is now in ruins. Can we sidetrack here and talk about what it felt like just to stand there and know what had been there and what is there now?
Poignant. It's very poignant because it was really sort of Clint Murchison's place, although he was partners with Toddie Lee Wynn and a fellow Dudley Golding. It really had the imprint of Clint Murchison. And then it became his partners, Toddie Lee Wynn's, and that's who it was identified with from, say, 1947 to 1987. And I know the kids and the grandkids, and I know the people who spent the time there. And to me, it was extremely poignant. It is belongs to the Department of the Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. To those fellows who were my escorts, it's really sort of a carbuncle that they would like to disappear, and they would like to see it pristine coastal grassland and habitat for whooping cranes, for Kemp sea turtles. And I think their point of view is exactly right, but they don't have any personal identification with the previous inhabitants. You know, they just don't have the funds to demolish it and haul all of that off of an island, so they're just letting it grow back. To me, to look into those rooms, it was extremely sad. I showed some of those photos to members of the Bass family who own Sid Richardson's house and island next door.
That's still in great shape and being used actively.
That's exactly right. It is pristine. And you could tell it sort of hit them. They found it poignant as well. They were like, wow. It's just wow.
And in fact, in later years, was it Murchison and his second wife that would go, like, deliberately hang out there to ride out hurricanes?
That was actually Sid Richardson partnered. He had no children. He partnered with his nephew, Perry Bass. And Perry and his wife, Nancy Lee, and they fathered you know, what we know monolithically as the Bass Brothers mm-hmm. in Fort Worth. And that was Perry and Nancy Lee's habit, which I found so eccentric. I could not believe it. And I asked their sons, and they said, oh, yes, that's exactly right. And the house is built in such a way. O'Neill Ford is a very famous modernist architect of the era who lived in Dallas at the time, intentionally built that house, as he said, tight enough to strum. It's 3 feet above sea level, and it's right in the teeth of, you know, where those hurricanes come through. And there's some very unique features of it to where, so far since 1938, as Perry Bass said, you know, we've had a little window damage when a hurricane throws a bird into a window, but otherwise, not too much damage. And he said he loved to go sit. He worked for his uncle, and his first project for his Uncle Sid was to build that house for him. And he said, it's quite an experience to sit in the house that I built and watch hurricanes form over the Gulf. And I thought of F. Scott Fitzgerald. The rich are different from you and me.
There's a lot about this story that is fascinating to me, but that I truly can't relate to, which just makes it kind of fun. Okay, so we have these two friends building houses, not simultaneously, but in sequence. I love the aspect of good old-fashioned Texas tall tale telling when it came to how much did you pay to put that thing up?
Well, that's exactly right. Clint set out to build really what was a hunting and fishing compound for his buddies. He was a widower, and he could sleep 35. And I think he dealt with his grief and his natural shyness by surrounding himself with associates. But it was a very usable house. Sid had a little more vision of making himself a compound. And so they had that sort of relationship. If Sid, as he started to build it, Sid was still borrowing money, but as his well started to come in, he started to spend more money, and he kept asking Clint, you know, how much did you spend? And, well, Clint had a house, he had a runway, he had put roads, he had to build his own generating house and bring diesel generators over so they could even use power tools, you know, had to build a water tower, had to drill wells. It just goes on and on. In the log that the president goes with the president, they say what his daily activities are. His military aide said, man, just the cold and hot storage houses of that place was a real eye-opener for the president. And so Sid would always say as he's building, what did you spend? And Clint would say, oh, you know, about $35,000, which people think it was probably over $100,000 that Clint spent.
And in the early 30s.
In the early 30s, that's right. And he was sticking it to Sid and gets it. Well, I may have to spend a little more. And estimates vary, but when Sid was through, it may have been around $200,000 that he had into it. And that was in the late 30s, which was still that, as
a lot of
in
money.
West Texas, that would get your teeth fixed.
We're speaking this hour with Alan Peppard, a staff writer with the Dallas Morning News, author of Islands of the Oil Kings, a three-part series about North Texas oil barons who set up these second homes and hosted historic guests on islands off the South Texas coast. Part three in that series goes live today at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Alan Peppard of the Dallas Morning News. His three-part series, Islands of the Oil Kings, is complete as of now. The third part is available, third and final part, as are the first two, online at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think at KERA.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. All right, so we know that FDR, spoiler alert, FDR visited in 1937,
yes.
And people may or may not be aware that he had family in Texas.
He did, and that story gets a little complex. His son, Elliot, number two son, number three if you count the son who died in infancy, at FDR's first inauguration, Elliot disappeared. Right after the swearing in. The problem was his wife and his child were still at the White House, and he just disappeared. And then the press found him 3 weeks later. Oh, the new president's son is in Little Rock, and then the new president's son is in Fort Worth. And he and his first wife ended up getting a Reno divorce, which was the way of the era. And married the daughter of a fairly prominent man in Fort Worth, and he settled in Fort Worth for quite a few years, and they had children. And two of Elliot Roosevelt's children live in Dallas now, and they have kids, and they have kids. And there is a long line of FDR right here in Dallas.
So it wouldn't be so unusual that he would come down to Texas for a visit. I was surprised to read, by the way, that in the height of the Depression that there was a presidential yacht that he was traveling on. But it turns out not to have been as opulent as it sounds.
That's exactly right. First of all, you have to remember there was no Air Force One. FDR was the first sitting president to fly. The first president to fly was Teddy Roosevelt, but it was after he was had left the White House.
So that wasn't the standard way he got around.
That's exactly right. And, of course, you have to remember he was paralyzed. So you have to get a paralyzed man in and out of a plane, and you're talking about the technology of airplanes of the 1930s.
Carrying people down the steps.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so boat. That's how he got somewhere. But Herbert Hoover had used the Sequoia, which a lot of people are familiar with, as a presidential yacht. It was really a Department of the Navy yacht and kind of got tasked to presidential service. But if there was a fear that Franklin Roosevelt had without the use of his legs, it was fire. And if you want to multiply that fear, what he really feared was a fire at sea. And it was very important to him not to have a wood boat. And so they took a metal Coast Guard cutter called the Electra, and they put a stateroom in it for him. And then they put a dummy smokestack on the back, and it had an elevator inside to get him between decks. What I found fascinating about that smokestack is the elevator was hand-operated. He would get in there himself and pull, you know, like a dumbwaiter, and he would pull himself between decks. If you read the eyewitness accounts of his visit to South Texas in May of 1937, everyone talks about when they greeted him how physically powerful he seemed, that his upper body was just, to use the current term, ripped.
He was still a big guy.
He was a big guy, and of course he had built up his upper body and was a big swimmer. And I found home movies, and you look in the home movies, and there are a lot of different angles, and you see his back, and he just has these very muscular shoulders and a very muscular back. So anyway, he could take care of himself, but he just he wanted a metal boat. It was not particularly opulent, nor was it particularly seaworthy. They brought him down in a destroyer and let the Potomac find its own way. That was the name of the ship, or the yacht was the Potomac, but they didn't risk him actually at sea in the Potomac.
So he was invited to spend a little time on San Jose Island, which
Correct.
Was Richardson's, and a little time on Matagorda, which was Murchison's. When I think back, I mean, obviously powerful people and politicians have gotten along well for a long time, but I wouldn't think that the interests of oil magnates would be the same as the interest of, you know, arguably our most liberal president ever.
I think the interest of Franklin Roosevelt, like any parent And any parent who has a child they might be concerned about was the welfare of the child. And Sid Richardson of Fort Worth had taken quite an interest in Elliot Roosevelt. Hmm. I believe that is what inspired the visit. He was on the Texas coast for, it depends how you count, but 8 or 9 days. And he only came ashore one time, and it was that day. And these were friends of Elliot's. And there was a lot of logistics to it. When I really looked at it, there's sort of a famous story about how to get him onto San Jose Island, because Sid Richardson had not built any improvements there yet. It would be another year before the house would start to go up. And there's sort of a famous story of them taking him down a cattle chute. But really, when I started analyzing, how did that happen? Well, Franklin Roosevelt was quite the yachtsman and quite the boating enthusiast all his life. And the Potomac had a tender, you know, to get to and from shore, which boat collectors would know is a twin cockpit Chris-Craft, you know, it's a little speedboat. And so I'm reading the president's log, and two sailors brought him down the kind of gangway of the yacht, and they set him right behind the wheel. FDR was going to drive himself into San Jose Island, which is absolutely what he did. He followed Sid Richardson's cabin cruiser, and they went up the bays there. People familiar with the kind of the Rockport area will know it's about 6 mile wide bay. And he followed him. Well, that Chris-Craft sat very, very low to the water. And you start to think about it. I looked at the home movies, and then you get in there these tall docks. You and I would stand up. We'd kind of grab the ladder. We'd sort of hang our butt out a little bit as we're trying to get up onto the dock. It's not an easy thing. How do you get a paralyzed man out of a low to the water Chris-Craft? And then, of course, the famous story is that there was very low, there was a chute where they would load livestock on the island, and they put his wheelchair in there, and Roosevelt said, "My God, Sid, are you going to roll me down that bull chute?" And Sid Richardson's famous response is, "Well, Mr. President, you're the biggest bull that's ever been down that chute." And that was sort of a Sid Richardson way to diffuse the powerful, and it's interesting, the home movies I have, they run kind of right up to that moment, and then they stop. And then the next, when it begins again, Roosevelt is sitting in Sid Richardson's convertible. And it informs you about the etiquette of not photographing Franklin Roosevelt when he was not at his most physically elegant.
By the way, why did Sid Richardson, who was charming and wealthy and had a million friends, I get that he didn't marry, but it seems like he didn't date.
Yes, and, you know, I told George Getchow, who's a well-known writer who runs the Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference. He and I had a conversation about, not just about that, but about how I didn't try to impress, I didn't try to interpret motivations of Murchison or Richardson or Wynne. I just tried to report the history. I said, I think it's interesting enough their interactions without my thumb on the scale. So I am reluctant to put my thumb on the scale of Sid Richardson. But I would say he really seemed to have no female associations, and Clint Murchison's second wife would say he was extremely shy around women, and he got very uncomfortable. There's a well-known story of Joan Crawford at a party really trying to just put the moves on him.
He was a catch.
Yes, he was a catch, and he got very upset. But there are also no stories of him and male companions. Sam Rayburn is a figure the same way. You know, you look at Sam Rayburn, he's the longest serving U.S. Speaker of the House, and you go back and wait, where are the women? Where are the men? I don't know really, I don't know about you, but I don't really know any people who were asexual in their orientation. I mean, I guess it exists. But also you have to remember the time. And so, you know, something was afoot, but I don't need to put my thumb on the scale and guess. So yes, Sid Richardson never married, didn't seem to have girlfriends, just his line was when Joan Crawford was going after him, he said, "Well, they're all looking for a landing field, but mine's fogged in."
All right, so at the end of this pretty successful meeting, right, a good time was had by all.
That really seems to be. Everybody seemed very happy.
FDR is about to leave, and he is introduced in Galveston to this upstart young freshman congressman.
That is exactly right. You have to look at the context of FDR's visit. He had just begun his second term, and he was extremely frustrated. He, in the first term, he drove through all this New Deal legislation. And just as you would have today, the other side of the question thought that it was a communist-socialist usurpation, and the Supreme Court just started throwing back all of this New Deal legislation. And Roosevelt proposed his famous court-packing bill, which was the pejorative term for it, but he called it court reorganization. He wanted to appoint up to six new Supreme Court justices. Basically, he wanted to tip the court. And everyone thought it was horrible. There was nobody. It just shut down the government. And that's when he said, I'm going fishing to Texas. Well, there was a special election in the 10th Congressional District, and there was a young fellow there who found that the New Deal was very popular with these constituents, and his whole platform was me and Roosevelt and court reorganization. And so they put a note in Roosevelt's file, you'll want to see this fellow when you go to Texas. His name is Lyndon Johnson. And when they put in at Galveston, Governor Jimmy Allred arranged the meeting. Now, Jimmy Allred is standing in the middle of the pictures, and Lyndon Johnson later had pictures made where he had Allred airbrushed out of those pictures, and even there's movies of it. And even in the home movies, you can physically see Johnson jostling and trying to really kind of get Jimmy Allred out of the picture. And Jimmy Allred, who was about half the size of Johnson, you can also see this was not his first rodeo. He was not budging. He was the governor. He was going to stand next to the president. And Lyndon could sit there and move all he wanted. But the films are interesting to watch.
Well, the president and his cronies were certainly good allies for LBJ. But LBJ proved to be a phenomenal fundraiser and may, in fact, have helped tip the balance of the 1940 presidential election.
That's exactly right. It wasn't so much the presidential election. It looked like Roosevelt was going to get a third term. The problem was Roosevelt had appointed his friend Ed Flynn as chairman of the Democratic Party. Ed Flynn was known as the boss of the Bronx. And Ed Flynn really had one political agenda, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In September of 1940, I know this gets a little highly detailed, but we're talking about 1940, September of 1940, the Speaker of the House, William Bankhead, falls over dead, and the House Majority Leader, Sam Rayburn from Bonham, Texas, gets promoted to Speaker of the House in September, but it looks like in an anti-Roosevelt backlash, the Democrats are going to lose the House in about 6 weeks. They didn't have any money. They'd go to Ed Flynn, give us money for these candidates. Here's $50 for your race. They'd go to the Congressional Campaign Committee. There's just no money to be had. And Lyndon Johnson was saying, I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. And everybody could read then, you know, he was just like Jimmy Allred, trying to elbow people out of the way. But finally, Sam Rayburn was desperate, and he went to Roosevelt, and he said, okay, we need to appoint him to the Congressional Campaign Committee. Ed Flynn did not like that at all. And Roosevelt made this accommodation. He goes, well, Lyndon, you are authorized to assist the committee. He walked out of the White House. He called George and Herman Brown in Texas, Brown and Root Construction. They each sent $5,000.
Which back then was a lot of money in politics.
1940, you bet. When you've got the party is sending $50 to candidates, they sent $5,000 each. And then Sid Richardson sent $5,000. And then Sid Richardson's nephew suddenly... Perry Bass sends $5,000. Clint Murchison sends $5,000. And in 3 days, it's $45,000. And in 10 days, it's almost $100,000. And Lyndon saw immediately that, yeah, the committee would love to have this money and take the credit for it. And he set up his own office in what's called the Muncie Building. He brought in a young fellow named John Conley. And he told the donors to send the checks to him, and he distributed them on behalf of the committee. And he had John Conley taking calls, find out what these candidates need in their district. Well, we need handbills. Well, we need to know how to do this. And Lyndon Johnson, in 3 weeks, is sending money to districts across the country. Franklin Roosevelt wins his third term. The Democrats keep the House. Sam Rayburn gets to maintain his position as Speaker of the House. And as I wrote, nothing changed, but everything changed. You had congressmen across the nation who suddenly owed their seat to 32-year-old Lyndon Johnson. It was his first taste of national power, and he found that it tasted pretty good.
And we can put a little asterisk here as well, because in 1942, when the Department of Defense, by eminent domain, took most of Matagorda Island to put a bombing range down, somehow the only part of the island they didn't need was right where Clint Murchison's property began.
That is correct. The military, and it is still a touchy subject, because the families that owned the land north of the Richardson Wynn American Liberty Oil fence line got paid a small pittance for their acreage.
Oh, sorry. It was already Wynn's by 42, right?
It was. They were partners by that time. Mm-hmm. Clint Murchison's partner had died. Todd E. Lewin, sort of complex what happened there. But Todd E. Lewin, they had become 50-50 partners in 1940. Anyway, those ranchers were given 10 days to move off. The Murchison land, Murchison Wynn land, was untouched. And there was a lot of strafing going on. I've put in the third story, which just went online, that Todd E. Lee Wynn would be down there with his young daughter, and the airplanes would strafe their targets on the beach, and then they'd thread the needle between the palm trees in front of the house with the canopy open. His 88-year-old daughter, she's still alive, and she told me, she goes, yeah, they'd come in with those canopies open, and Mom would look up and go, well, that one's got a mustache. Look at that. That's how low they came in. So it wasn't exactly peaceful, but the land was untouched. Next door on Sid Richardson's island, baby, they didn't touch it. It's, they didn't drop any bombs or shoot anything on that island. And there are still some bad feelings about that today.
Money talks, whether you like what it says or not.
I agree.
We're speaking with Alan Peppert, a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of the three-part series Islands of the Oil Kings. Part 3 has just gone live. You can find it online at dallasnews.com, along with parts 1 and 2. If you'd like to join our conversation, we will take your calls after this break. 1-800-933-5372 is our number, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dallas Morning News staff writer Alan Peppert. His three-part series, Islands of the Oil Kings, is now completely available online at dallasnews.com. Part 3 just went live. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Jay in Pilot Point. Hey, Jay.
Hello. Good night. Interesting stories. I've been following it closely in the newspaper.
Thank you, Jay.
I was stationed in Corpus in training command there, and we used to overfly those islands all the time as part of our training area. Now, off one of the islands, which I think was Matagorda, there was a sunken submarine in the surf line, and we always thought it might have been a German submarine caught during World War II, but we never really knew. Wonder if you ever found any information about that.
I did hear that I did a lot of study with the Port Aransas Preservation and Historical Society, and I can't confirm, but they seem there's pretty much a certainty that U-boats were operating there, and the jetties, which open up into those bays at Port Aransas, were a pretty sensitive area. I got, after part one published, I got a fascinating letter from a man whose grandfather was island manager for Sid Richardson on San Jose, which they called St. Joe in those days. And he sent me pictures from World War II of his mother as a little girl on the island. And he said once the U-boat situation developed that they left the island, that Sid Richardson, in a very John Wayne way, ordered women and children back to the mainland. And I don't know whether they felt like that the black shirts and brown shirts would come storming ashore at San Jose Island. But still, I think there definitely were U-boats operating in that area. That, you know, Corpus Christi is the fourth busiest port in the nation today, and that's the opening to all of it right there. And even then, it was, as I fondly say, the petroleum underbelly of Texas right there.
So when we talk about this history, there is sea travel, there is air travel, and there is space travel involved.
There is.
Or spacecraft, I should say.
Yes. Well, Todd E. Lee Wynn, he and Clint Murchison divided their interests in the 40s, and he became the sole owner of American Liberty Oil and the sole owner of Matagorda Island, at least their 9 miles of it.
By coin toss, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yes. And I was very impressed that he was so enthusiastic about a plan to build a company to launch payloads into space to compete with NASA to launch satellites. And so this company out of Houston, Space Services, they built their own rocket, and they took it to Matagorda Island. There's a long story. I could write a 3-part series on the licensing of how do you launch a rocket. It's a little more sophisticated now. The FAA is a little touchy about that in 1982. And, well, okay, you're going to be out on this barrier island. Even then, it was a little touchy, and with good reason. So the first one they put up on the platform, have an engine test, and kaboom. It blew sky high and started a brush fire. And Deke Slayton, who had just retired as head of the astronaut office at NASA, came aboard, and he was like, yeah, let's not reinvent the wheel. And they bought 2 ICBMs from the government.
They were Intercontinental Ballistic Missiles.
That's right. Minutemen. They were the hottest technology of 1961, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis stuff. But they will go straight up in a fairly routine manner. And so they took the bottom end of it, and they put their own sort of payload on it, and they set up for a launch on Matagorda in 1982. I don't know if I'm going to get ahead of what you're going to ask me to tell you what happened, but go ahead.
Well, let's go back and talk about how the island and the business were decided by coin toss, which seems like a strange way to do things. I mean, there was money exchanged, but basically there were questions about, as they decided to part company, Murchison and Wynn, how this would all shake out.
That's exactly right. Todd E. Lee Wynn of Dallas had been a lawyer, and he had been Clint's very able legal advocate, and Clint needed one in the 1930s because he was kind of known as the king of the hot oilers, selling oil illegally above what the federal government imposed as a limit on production from the East Texas oil field. He felt this was just, I don't want to say communism, socialism, militarism. He hated it, and so he named his company American Liberty. This is an un-American infringement of my liberty. And Todd E. Lee Wynn is his lawyer, tied him up in court for a long time. And while that was all being fought, the oil continued to flow through the pipelines. I'm getting a little off there. But then they became 50-50 partners. And then in 1946, they decided to end the partnership. How do you divide this fairly substantial company? And they decided that it was going to be a buy-or-sell. And they would flip a coin, and whoever won the toss could decide, did he want to buy out the other, or did he want to sell his share? And it seemed almost certain to Clint Murchison, who was one of the most famous independent oil operators in the country, that, well, the lawyer, he'd want to sell. He'd take the money, and Clint would continue to operate the oil company. That just only seemed obvious. So sure, we'll flip a coin and kind of, you know, heads I win, tails you lose. He figured he had it in the bag. And they flipped the coin. Todd E. Lee won. And he said, I'll take American Liberty Oil. I'll buy. And Clint Murchison was astonished for the rest of his life at that choice. He was just astonished that Todd E. Lee had made that choice. And it depends whether you talk to the Wynns or the Murchisons, what later interpretations of motivations were. Some are very straightforward. Some have less charitable characterizations. But Clint Murchison was astonished, and he cleaned out his office and went fishing. It's kind of hard to imagine, because in 1954, he was on the cover of Time magazine. He and Sid Richardson helped a friend take over the New York Central Railroad. You're talking the Vanderbilts and the Morgans, and he and Sid had cash in those days, and those people didn't. And they were able to mount a very substantial fight for control of that railroad. They're enormous financiers, but roll back to 1946, 47. He's cleaning out his office. He doesn't even have a telephone. He's like, well, okay. And so he took a new office downtown. It was a very dramatic division.
Wynne would eventually die on the island.
Almost. Depends how you
slept his last night on the island.
He sure did. He sure did. I was blessed. That was, I told you, what started me on the story was I was interested in how Franklin Roosevelt ended up on that island. And then the other story is, wait, they had a privately funded space launch, and you're talking 32, 33 years before Elon Musk comes along. I looked it up. I think Elon Musk was 11 years old when this happened, and it was successful. And so Toddie Lee Wynne is down on the island. He's very excited. He's had heart trouble since 1943. That's one of the reasons they divided the partnership. And he goes and visits the launch site. He's talking to all the technicians. He's talking to Deke Slayton. He's 85 years old. He's happy as he can be. And I was blessed because I found his 88-year-old daughter in Montana, and she was with him all that day, and she gave me a minute-by-minute account. And they had a movie kind of theater at the house there on Matagorda, and they watched a John Wayne movie that last night, and they stop and change reels. They pass around the chocolate candy. Daddy is all excited because this is the future, and he's part of it. And this is the house where he entertained Roosevelt. And then at about 2 a.m., the nurse comes in and goes, "Your daddy is not well." And they pulled his big plane out, and they took him to Presbyterian in Dallas. That was the plan. And he was one of the founders of Presby. And that plane went roaring down the runway. It was really striking to me. There's no lights on those runways. And it's just black there. When you get down on that island at night, it's black. And they point that big plane, big airliner, down the runway. And they lifted off in blackness at 2:10 a.m. over the Gulf of Mexico. And his daughter, Sissy, told me as soon as the wheels left the ground, he was lying on the sofa and she was on the floor next to him. She said as soon as the wheels left the ground, he took his last breath.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Sam in Fort Worth. Hi, Sam.
Hi. There is another aspect of Elliot Roosevelt in Texas. I grew up in Fort Worth at a time that Elliot was living in with one wife or another at what was called Dutch Branch, and was a member of the Episcopal Church where the family went. And my touch with greatness came when Elliot Jr., fourth or fifth, and I got into an argument, and I punched him out.
Goodness. Did you get in trouble, Sam?
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, you know, were the Secret Service goons coming for you?
No, this was long after, before the Secret Service followed ex-presidents or families of ex-presidents.
Right.
This would be about 1946. I have to say that the reason Elliot was in Fort Worth was to keep him away from the press. And
I think there's a lot to that.
A job had been constructed for him by Sid Richardson and others. They created something called the Bluebonnet Radio Network, and Elliot was made president of it. And that was to keep him quiet and away from the press. Of course, it didn't work, but that network is now TSN.
That's correct. And as soon as Franklin Roosevelt was in his grave, Elliot got pulled before the House Ways and Means Committee and grilled by the IRS about a series of unpaid personal loans from Sid Richardson, from John Hartford, the owner of A&P. Once the president was no longer there to cover his flank, Elliot's weaknesses were rather garishly exposed.
Did you get to spend time on San Jose Island?
You know, it's owned by the Bass family of Fort Worth, and I have met with them extensively after the fact, and they've been so kind. And somebody asked me that yesterday. Did you get to spend time on San Jose Island? And I said, well, we did this sort of Apocalypse Now, Sunrise, Ride of the Valkyries.
helicopter tour?
We weren't going to spend that money. We used a Cessna 172, and I was about 300 feet over the house with the door open and a photographer hanging out the window, and we had all flaps down. And about 300 feet, doing about 70 miles an hour with a ranch manager with binoculars on us going, well, who is that? And I said it wasn't exactly like Sid Bass opening up a bottle of Cabernet for me in the living room, but, you know, I got a pretty good look.
There's no Dallas Morning News drone?
It is against the law to use drones for commercial purposes. I can tell you all about that law.
Well, you guys wouldn't be the first one to break that law if it happened, but... So obviously there are a lot of details, even in the pieces, that we haven't gotten to.
Correct.
Do you have a favorite? Was there something that surprised you more than everything else you learned?
I was surprised at how, you know, the names Sid Richardson and Clint Merkson, parts one and two of the story were really Clint and Sid stories about their friendship, and they were so large. And Toddie Lee Wynn, well known regionally, but not a national figure. I was surprised that once he took over Matagorda Island, it got really nice. You know, I'm looking at pictures. I've got a lot of old photos, and suddenly you start seeing curbs on the roads, and it's like, curbs!
It was, like, finished out under his
yes,
care.
And all kinds of structures. He really made it very nice. And I guess what I was also very surprised at, I was down there October 6th and 7th, and it's a very wild place, and rattlesnakes are a real problem, and there's every kind of animal you can imagine, and the heat is bad, and you know, the Fish and Wildlife guys were kind of looking at me like, you know, is he going to make it through the afternoon? What daring it took for those men to go, yeah, this is a good place for our seat of power. There's no electricity. You've got to have your own water. Everything has to come in by boat or plane. Yeah, we're going to do it here. It, to me, is an incredibly bold idea.
Is it just the optimism of great wealth?
Merkison and Richardson were, they were pioneers. Richardson left Matagorda. He had the architects of Highland Park Village build him a house so remote in Mexico. It's in Tamaulipas, and he had a 75,000-acre ranch. He did it again. It might as well have been an island, much more remote than Matagorda.
Alan Peppard is a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of the interactive series Islands of the Oil Kings. All three parts are available online now at dallasnews.com. Alan, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, I appreciate you having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.